Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Nicole Quinn. Welcome to the Lab Coats and Life podcast, where we help scientists thrive. My co-host today is Dr. Arun Sharma, co-host of the Stem Cell podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. The Lab Coats and Life podcast is brought to you by Stem Cell Technologies, a global biotechnology company supporting life sciences research and fostering communication and collaboration in science. If you enjoy the Lab Coats and Life podcast, rate us and leave a review. You can also suggest ideas or recommend guests for new episodes. Today, we are excited to welcome Dr. Caroline Hookway from the Allen Institute for Cell Science to the Lab Coats and Life podcast. Dr. Hookway joined the assay development group at the Allen Institute in 2016. She is involved in designing imaging experiments that reveal the organization of the internal components of cells. She obtained her PhD at Northwestern, characterizing the microtubule-dependent transport and dynamics of the intermediate filament protein vimentin in the lab of Vladimir I. Gelfand, and did her undergraduate studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Hookway is joining Arun and I today to discuss how to keep up with new technologies for your research. We all know that scientists need to keep up with new discoveries in their field, and there are mechanisms and resources to help with that, like, for example, listening to podcasts. But we also need to keep up with our awareness and understanding of, as well as our ability to actually use and apply new technologies in the lab, which advance very quickly. This is part of Caroline's job, and she's going to share some wisdom with us all. But before we get to that, would you like to organize a journal club but aren't sure where to start? Visit www.stemcell.com/journalclub to find free downloadable checklists and templates, including an attendance sheet, preparation checklist, presenter evaluation form template, and more.
Thank you for being here, Dr. Hookway. It's great to interact with you again. I know we've had some other conversations and some of the space-related stuff that I've been doing on the side, but this is really going to be emphasis on technology and the technology that you're working on at the Allen Institute for Cell Science and the work that you're pioneering there. And also, you know, a way for our listeners, our trainee listeners, to get a better feel for how technology can be utilized for greater scientific reasons and for, you know, other advances. So you're part of the Allen Institute for Cell Science, one of my really my favorite research teams in all of biomedical research for personal, professional reasons, of course, in part because the amazing resources you develop for the community. You're involved in initiatives focusing on understanding how cells grow and develop and predicting their future developmental path. And this is all essential for understanding human health. And like I said, I've worked with some of the resources your team develops as well, including these fluorescent reporter lines that we've actually sent to space, you know, side note. So really, before we dive deeper into the, I guess, the non-technical side of things, could you give us a scientific overview of what you and your team are working on today and into the near future at the Allen Institute for Cell Science?
Sure. Well, we actually have several scientific programs, but I'll tell you the one that I'm focused on working on. So I focus on the experimental side of things here. I'm less computational, but I interact with the computational folks on a daily basis. And having that back and forth between the experimental and computational is really important for what we do. In particular, what I do on the scientific side is I co-lead a program that studies a state change that happens with the differentiation of our stem cells really early on in a number of different differentiation programs, and that is the epithelial to mesenchymal transition, or the EMT. So we're using the EMT as a model for understanding how cells undergo state changes from having sort of one organization and one function to having another one.
Amazing. So let's start to dive into this technology bit, because I know you use a lot of cool tools and techniques in your research. And the usual path for a scientist is, you know, they learn their techniques and their technologies in their graduate and postdoc studies, and they kind of take those, that skill set, and then they apply it to different questions when they move on to do their own research. And you are continuing to build on your technology skills and the technologies you use in your research and using new technologies to go deeper into questions. So can you talk about this? Have you always been interested in technology? To me, it seems like you are pushing the boundaries of technology as well as your academic questions. And do you agree with that? And maybe give me some background on yourself.
Well, I think I would start with saying that I think as a scientist, there's always this sort of delicate balance between wanting to use the most cutting edge technologies and also understanding what the technologies are that you need for your scientific question at hand. And of course, on the one hand, like if you, well, I guess these new technologies enable us to think of questions that we might not have ever thought of before. But on the other hand, we can make really big impact and novel discoveries using sort of quote unquote older technologies. And when I first started at the Allen Institute, I remember there being sort of a little bit of internal controversy over new technology versus old technology. And in our case, especially because we embrace open science and wanting our tools and things to be available to the community, we have to be really careful about what technologies we can make accessible to everyone and which things are a little bit more limited due to legal reasons. So the biggest technology question in the beginning was, what fluorescent protein do we use to tag things? And what kind of imaging do we do? And the decision was made to use EGFP, which is sort of an older generation of fluorescent protein. There are ones out there now that are much brighter, for example. But we started with the old tried and true because we knew it would work. There would be less controversy about what it could be perturbing in the cell. And so we went with that, and it works beautifully in most cases. And now we're discovering there are some cases where it doesn't work so well for us. And we have since then evolved to embrace different technologies and reach out to people and figure out what are potentially better types of labels that we could use in cells. And then the other big technology is imaging technology. And our workhorse microscopes that we use are spinning disc confocal microscopes. And it's a relatively newer technology. Actually, it's not old, but I think the newer cutting edge thing that was happening at the same time was the boom of super resolution microscopy. And super resolution microscopy, of course, produces these beautiful images that gives you really well resolved things that break the diffraction limit of light. And so, you know, we could use super resolution microscopes and have really beautiful images, but we didn't necessarily need that level of resolution for the questions that we were asking. And so we decided to use the spinning disk microscopes to give us a higher throughput of images to produce the thousands or actually hundreds of thousands of cells that we needed for our first types of analyses.
It's a really interesting point, that balance between what's available and then what's accessible. And do you, when you've been making these decisions to, you know, do we push and use like the actual, you know, the best, the most recent, the most cutting edge stuff, or do we use what's tried and true? Does the question of reproducibility come into there? Like, you know, somebody else somewhere else in the world wanted to build on your research and didn't have access to whatever that really fancy microscope that you just told us about was. Is that a factor in your decisions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that more and more people are recognizing the challenge of scientific reproducibility, and especially in the imaging space. We're now involved with working with BINA, the Bioimaging North America, and QARIP, which is quality control. I don't know what QARIP stands for, but those two.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, but they're organizations that are focusing on how to make imaging standards across the board for everyone who's doing imaging so that we can know from one system to another the types of images that are being created are comparable, and that the images that I create are things that, you know, you and your lab can create if you had the same type of microscopes and you could set the same settings. So that's really important, I think, for science.
Yeah, we talk about it a lot on the Stem Cell Podcast. We're really in the middle of a golden age of technology, and in particular, a golden age, in my mind, in imaging technology. You know, we have, for example, CRISPR-Cas9 and all these genome editing approaches that allow you to generate these custom fluorescent lines. But in addition to the, you know, combine that with the spinning disk confocal and all these amazing imaging modalities that can really piece apart and dissect what's happening at the cellular level and the molecular level in a way that's never been done before. And really, I think the Allen Institute is leading that charge in a lot of ways. You're at the cutting edge of these scientific advances, in part because you have access to these amazing, cool new technologies. and you try to democratize those technologies as much as you can to let the greater community use them as well. I mean, like you're talking about, you specialize in live cell imaging, assay development. So we want to learn, I want to know more about how you actually learn about these new technologies, you know, when you develop them in the Allen Institute. So how do the scientists at the Allen Institute for Cell Sciences keep their skills sharp and find out about new technologies related to your work that ultimately you can bring into the AICS? I mean, is it just a matter of paying close attention to the literature, traveling broadly to conferences, talking to a bunch of people, social media? So what does it really take to stay current with the cutting edge biomedical advances, in particular with imaging?
Well, I think it's probably similar to what you just said and what you'd probably do, which is, I think, keeping up to date with the published literature or even preprints, definitely preprints, as well as going to scientific conferences. And I think the biggest one is communicating with scientific peers and talking to people. So working at the Allen, we're a little bit more visible. And so the ability to reach out to other people, I think, is a little bit easier than, per se, if you are from some small academic lab and you're trying to reach out to this expert on some technology that you're interested in, they might ignore you. Whereas being at the Allen, we're less likely to get ignored. So that's definitely a privilege that I feel very fortunate to have. And people are generally very excited and willing to talk to us and share their knowledge. So in terms of what types of technology we're after, I think you're right. We're interested in everything from, you know, what are the technologies, what are the imaging technologies, what are the CRISPR editing technologies that might be useful for us, what are the labeling technologies, but also we're more recently thinking about not just what these technologies are, but what are the ways in which we can connect them together. So how can we take different ways of observing and measuring and using experiments to understand cells and connect those pieces of data together? And so we're thinking about ways that technologies can be linked together. And so, for example, my group most recently has been doing experiments where we image cells live. We do time-lapse imaging so we can see what they're doing over time. And then we fix them right there in the microscope so that then we can label them with a whole bunch of different markers to see more fluorescent proteins than we could ever label in a live cell. But because we had the time lapse just before it, then we can link together the dynamic time information with the information about sort of the contents of other types of proteins in the cell.
So for someone like me, who is incredibly intimidated by technology, and being aware of what technologies are out there is one thing to tackle. But the second thing to tackle is, like, how do you do it? And So do you offer courses for your internal employees? Like, how do they actually learn? Because for myself, like, I remember we got a qPCR machine in our lab, and more than half the lab, almost everyone in the lab was super excited. They're like, let me get at it. And I was like, I'm so intimidated by this machine. I don't know how to use it. I want to use the stuff I already know how to do. So how do you get over that barrier?
Well, I think there's both a lot of information out there that, and if you search sort of a wide nest, you know, I'm thinking about if you do like a literature search and you put in a general term, you're going to get thousands of hits, and then filtering through that, like, it's just not possible. And then on the other hand, if you put in a search term that's really specific, then you get too few hits and you might miss something like the technology you might want, but in a different context, but that could still be really helpful to you. And so I think that, like, really what you do is you kind of do both things and you do the best you can in one sense. But in the other sense, as soon as you find something to latch on to, in my case, I think it's people. I think that the communication piece is the most important. And as soon as you find someone who knows more than, or, you know, as soon as I find someone who knows more than I do about a given technology that I'm interested in, I immediately want to talk to them and pick their brains and ask them, you know, maybe you don't have time to tell me everything that I need to know. Can you tell me who else I can talk to? Can you tell me where I should find this information? Can you tell me the search terms I should be using? Maybe I don't understand the vocabulary as well as I should. And that helps a lot. And I think that lowering the barrier for you know, intimidation of being scared to use these new technologies is done by talking to the people who are doing it, because they can tell you the real practicality of using these technologies. Sometimes you get the impression from reading in a paper like, oh, all I have to do is buy these reagents and plug and play and I can do this. And it's actually, there's a lot more nuances to the actual thing than you can pick up from just reading the paper. And if you just try it, you're going to fail and be really demoralized. So you need help. And I think that there are things in progress now to try and you know, decrease that limitation. There's, you know, better guidelines now for how to include information in your materials and methods and papers and so on. But I think ultimately, if you can, the ability to like actually talk to someone or the ability to go to someone else's lab and see how they're using that technology is really, you know, the best way to lower the intimidation factor of how difficult it's going to be.
I think that intimidation factor is really important to touch on, not just from the perspective of learning a new technology, but some people are intimidated by approaching the people who are developing that technology and are masters and experts of that technology. So, I mean, since this is a mentorship focused podcast, I think it'd be also really important to talk a little bit about how trainees and junior investigators can overcome that intimidation of actually talking and networking with the people developing those technologies. Like I'm a PI, so from my perspective, if I see a talk at a conference where I see a new technology that I want to bring into my lab, I just shout with the speaker afterwards, and it sounds like you're pretty comfortable with doing that too. But trainees, junior investigators aren't always that comfortable. So how can a junior investigator, a trainee, overcome some of those barriers and approach these, you know, developers of new technologies? What's your secret?
Well, I guess the thing that I've done throughout my training and the way that I've gotten this experience is to piggyback on other people. So if I'm at a conference and I see some PIs that are talking about technology, I'll just kind of, you know, saddle right up to next to them and join in the conversation and you don't have to do that by, you know, butting in and saying, here I am. You know, you can kind of just look interested, and usually they're plenty happy to include you in the conversation. And if not, you know, I just say, oh, you know, sorry, and I walk away. But generally that's been a pretty successful tactic for me. I think the other is that, like, conferences, I think, are a really great place to actually put faces to names and to meet people, especially at poster sessions. So at poster sessions, people want you to come and they want to talk about their poster and talk to you. And that's really where you can meet the real people who are actually doing the work, not always just the PI. It'll usually be the grad student or the postdoc or the, you know, scientist who's doing the work that then you can talk to and make connections that way.
I wanted to dig back. I think those are excellent answers. And I know as a grad student, I hated making posters, but I loved presenting them because people would actually come up and talk to me. So, I wanted to ask, when you were saying things like search terms and what you put in, and I know for at StemCell, for example, for the instruments and the protocols that we offer, we try to create videos. And so is YouTube or, you know, vendor websites, are those the kinds of places you're putting in these search terms? And I'm curious about YouTube specifically, because I think it's a cool new way to communicate science. And I think we've been a bit late adopting it as scientists, but you know, I'm doing a house renovation right now, and I can't tell you how many YouTube videos we've watched on how to do little things in our renovation. And do scientists use that, or should they be doing it more for techniques in the lab?
That's a great question. I can't say that I have used YouTube much for learning new technologies myself, but I think it's a great idea to do it. I know that, you know, the Allen Institute for Cell Science makes plenty of videos about our SOPs and how to culture the cells and so on. And so it's surprising to me that I wouldn't have thought of the flip side. You know, it's kind of short-sighted of me, to be honest. I should definitely look into that more. And so I think I will. But yeah, when you were saying, when we were talking about search terms, I was thinking of just, you know, when going into PubMed on NCBI and putting in search terms, but more and more that's become going to Google and putting in keywords and search terms and searching both ways. And when you search Google, you're going to find hits that are not just published in things in preprints, but also things like movies and YouTube hits. So I think that's definitely a good way to also be searching.
Yeah, YouTube, Instagram, maybe even TikTok for this current generation. You never know, right? Science communication has all sorts of avenues, as we understand here on the podcast. And we were talking about, how we can make these technologies more accessible to not just, steady users, common users, expert users, but also people who are learning these things for the first time, trainees, junior investigators, right? I mean, there's so many advanced technologies out there. You talked about, spinning disk confocal, all these advanced imaging modalities. Oftentimes, these things require specialized training and expertise to use. Even at my institution, we have core facilities and people hired specifically to use those machines on behalf of other people because they're so complicated to use, like, fax machines, confocals, all these kind of things, right? But when it comes to the typical user for, say, I don't know, a spinning disk confocal, that person may not understand the fundamental scientific principles behind how the tech actually works. But do they need to? Is there actually still utility in knowing the basic steps, the basic science behind some of these advanced level, high level technologies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it probably depends on what it is that you want to do with them. I think in general that someone operating a piece of machinery is just going to be able to operate it better if they know how it works. And so in a lot of our training, we do go through how the technology works, but the part that people remember and take away with them is how to operate the piece of machinery and how to use the software to make it run. And so on the one hand, no, I don't think you need to understand it, but I think it's helpful in a lot of cases. I'm trying to think of an example of like when you might want to know. I think
something goes wrong, like when something goes wrong and your images don't show up the way you thought they were going to, or the machine breaks, or you have a deadline and you have to go back to the basic.
Sure. Yeah, definitely like troubleshooting and knowing if the problem is, is my objective dirty, or is it the wrong filter, or is the laser coming on? Those are all sort of very basic, like what is my light path? Which camera is my light going to? Those are all questions that really help with troubleshooting if the image isn't what you expect it to be.
Yeah, I remember another story from back when I was so intimidated by technology, and there was a machine in the lab to do some microarray work, and it wasn't working. And this technician who'd been in the lab for years and years and years climbed up and brought a box down from like the top shelf. It was this dusty old box full of like canisters and this printed protocol. And he's like, "We're going to do it by hand now." And he was able to show me how to, it was way slower, way more work. I was literally like using my wrist to turn canisters and bathe microarrays for days and days and days. But without that, we would have been kind of frozen in time for a little while until we could figure out how to fix the machine. So I think the troubleshooting aspect is probably important. But yeah, there's some like, we're never going to go back to doing PCR by putting vials and water baths anymore. We're just gonna turn the machine on. So I think in some ways we can just rely on that new technology. I want to go back to something you were talking about around making technology accessible, and we talked about the privilege of being in a well-funded institute or a well-known institute that has high visibility, and certainly that's going to carry over to well-funded labs. But if we're thinking about on a global front where there's not access necessarily to technologies, the latest technologies in around the world, what can we do as scientists? And I'm not specifically putting any responsibility on you or the Allen Institute. I want to just think broadly as a scientific community, what needs to change for us to be able to, really truly democratize science and really make it so that we don't have the more wealthy institutions or the more wealthy countries running away with the science and leaving the rest of the world behind? Any thoughts? It's a big, deep question, I know.
That's a big question, yeah. let's see. Well, I think, thinking about it on the global scale is really the largest scale we can think of. So I'm going to start with thinking about a smaller scale. Let's just think about the US. How can we get smaller labs with less funding to be able to use newer technologies? I think one sort of, knee-jerk reaction I have to this is, oh my gosh, these labs should all have more funding. And one of the things that really frustrates me as a scientist is limitations of funding, and that You know, the NIH, which is the major source of funding for life science research in this country, gets less and less funding by the government. And we really need for our government and for, you know, our fellow Americans that live in this country to understand and value the benefit of funding life science research. And if there were more funding, then, you know, you'd have more labs that have more resources and can do more cutting edge science. And there would be less, I think, negative competition and more collaboration between labs if people weren't so afraid of being scooped and, you know, fighting at scrambling for funding. I think that would just free up a lot of creativity. So I think that's one big issue at hand. It might also be a more global issue. I'm less aware of it in other countries. I don't know what the funding is for life science research all over the world. But I think in other ways, there are, I think things like core facilities are really helpful for a lot of labs that can't necessarily afford to buy, for example, the most cutting edge microscope, but maybe they can be part of an institution that owns a few that they can book time on and have access to. Of course, you need a facility then that has support for training and that will help you actually use those instruments to be successful using them. And things like what you mentioned, you know, videos and how-tos and that kind of training could be very helpful in that space too, I think. But I don't know. I feel like I haven't totally addressed your question.
No, you did. You had two very good points. And I'm wondering, Arun, if you have anything to add to that big meaty question.
Yeah. I mean, I think the topic of core facilities has come up a couple of times already in this conversation, but I think it's worth chatting about. I mean, like you said, they can be an incredibly powerful resource for investigators at a particular institution. I mean, one thing we're actually exploring in our institution is ways to extend our core facilities to users outside of our institution. For example, mm-hmm. I'm in Los Angeles, and could we have certain really great core facilities in my mind that are the best in the city, but perhaps could we extend those resources to other folks across town to use? Mm-hmm. Is this something that the AICS Allen Institute is in, you know, thinking about? Maybe how the greater Washington, Seattle area might be able to utilize some of those facilities that you have?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. No, we haven't thought about that. Or I don't know. I haven't been part of any conversations about that anyway. I think that it would be really difficult for us because, you know, while we do have a lot of microscopes, we are constantly using them ourselves for our own data generation purposes. So you'd really have to get, you know, a whole suite of instruments that you yourself aren't planning to totally hog all of the time. And that is something that we haven't done. Yeah, I think that's a hard problem. How do you convince, you know, and who's paying for it? And, you know, if you're a small lab, maybe you have access to this now, but maybe you still can't afford the, you know, the large amount of dollars that it might cost for you to spend time on this equipment. So I don't know.
I think it's, these are messy problems and they're things that we need to think about as scientists. And it always comes down to money, right? But there is, I think we need to think differently about how science is funded. There's a lot of institutions and organizations and societies out there that are popping up with private funding and philanthropic funding. And if as scientists, if we can direct that funding to the to mechanisms that are going to be much more accessible to across the scientific community, then we can kind of put our thoughts towards that and our advice towards it. The other thing I would add to this is more funding for travel for international and sort of reducing the visa barriers for international mm-hmm. trainees and scientists to be able to come and spend a couple months in a place where they may have some training available, or maybe even they can do a part of their research at a core in a place that there's more. There's more to offer. And then using the internet a little bit better. Like I always say, scientists were so slow to adopt the internet. And, you know, what can we put out there and make available to people all over the world to help at least reduce the barriers of knowledge? And then we can start maybe reducing the physical barriers of getting people at the right places or getting instruments into the right places. But I think there's a lot of ways that we can think about how to ensure that technologies are in everybody's hands and accessible to everybody around the world. Okay, Caroline, we we would like to hear from you if there's anything that we didn't ask you, anything, any thoughts that you were like, I really wanted to say this one thing and I didn't really get the opportunity.
Well, I think being a sort of mentoring, soft skills side of science podcast, there was one piece of advice that Rick Horowitz, the original executive director of the Allen Institute for Cell Science, told me, and it really has impacted the way that I think as a scientist. And so I think I would tell that to you, even though it may or may not relate to new technologies. And that is that in a lot of our scientific training, you know, as grad students, you're really taught to be skeptical and critical of information. And you read a paper and you tear apart what you think is wrong with it. And that really teaches your brain to pick apart and think about, you know, what's wrong with, I don't know, a given study or what you might be doing. And it can really inhibit the creative process, because as you're a scientist and you're thinking about what, you know, oh, maybe I can do this. Oh no, that's not a good idea. Oh, maybe I should try this new piece of technology, let's say, in this space. And like, oh no, I don't think it would work here. It really prevents you from being able to think more fully. And instead, if you separate those things, if you give yourself or the people you work with space to just be creative and without the part where you're being critical or skeptical. And then you take what you think of and you then at another time go back and be skeptical about it. I think it really opens up a lot of possibilities for what you might discover and what you might think. And at the Allen Institute, I am really glad that we have embraced that kind of way or procedure about doing science. So for example, we have these brainstorming sessions, and in the brainstorming sessions, it's highlighted to us that we need to think about what we could do, not what we should do. And once we have on the table all the things that we could do or we might want to do, then we go back to that and think about, well, what are the things that we should do? What's feasible here? What's not? And just having it be two separate things really brings a lot more to the table for us to think about.
I love it. Thank you for sharing that. I always tell people that science is so inherently creative. And I think we forget that because we have to be so logical and methodical and, you know, follow process. And that's all true as well. But you have to also be able to come up with big ideas and pursue those big ideas and take risks. So I love that way of thinking. Arun, did you have any parting words, anything you wanted to say that, you know, didn't really come out in the main conversation?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you again, Dr. Hukwe, for joining us. The Allen Institute for Cell Sciences is one of my favorite, if not my favorite, scientific team across the entire world, just because of the amazing resources you develop. And perhaps down the road, we can have you back on the show to talk a little bit more about our space collaboration as well.
That would be great. Thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you both. Okay, everyone, that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to sign up for our email list at www.labcoatsandlifepodcast.com to get show notes, episode summaries, and links to useful information, or learn more about STEM mentorship via the resources found at www.stemcell.com/labcoatsandlife. You can also reach out to us on Twitter via StemCell at StemCellTech or via email at info@labcoatsandlifepodcast.com with feedback or to suggest guests.